what would you say that Radio Free Iraq's primary mission is now in 2009 compared to, say, what it was back in 2003 or 2004?
Well, in 2003 and 2004, Saddam was still there and was very actively sought for. And his shade was everywhere in Iraq. I mean, let's be frank, I mean, people were scared. Even he was someplace nobody knew where he was hiding, everyone was scared of him. At that point, the challenge was to keep delivering people the information that was previously denied to them by Saddam's regime. And it was an act of bravery. Some of our current listeners are telling us stories in which they survived being caught red-handed listening to Radio Free Iraq because they thought it's the end of the universe for them. An army colonel was caught by one of his subordinates listening to Radio Free Iraq. So now this person is no longer in the army. And he called to one of our call-in programs and told us this story. This is actually the story why he is still with us, because he's still checking, you know, how we are against others. And that's and I'm really happy that he does it regularly. And he actually cared to pick up the phone and call us. The thing now, Iraq is going through circles of transitions from that society under Saddam into hopefully what would be a more free society and more democratic society. It's not an easy way. There are many obstacles. Some of them are seen from outside. Some of them are seen only from the inside. Many outsiders do not understand them, while insiders do not really care to tell about how they feel. The primary goal, to keep delivering the objective, balanced, unbiased information. In Iraq, it's very important because in Iraq, there are so many factions, so many different shades of opinion. Opinions are so intolerant to each other that, you know, just many, and there are so many news organizations that belong to political groups and that deliver predominantly these groups' political agenda. It's very rare to see something that is not involved in this, that is above it, that cares to bring to the listeners as much information as possible without trying to bend this listener into one or the other side. Also, we do not twist the facts, because if you want to present the world in one way, you inevitably end up manipulating in a way somehow facts. Either not delivering the full picture, or, you know, making it sort of better looking than from your perspective, things like that. We don't do that. Besides, the agenda is also, since we want to deliver as much information as possible, to create as full picture as possible, we are trying to present as many points of view that exist there, and put them in a civilized debate, not the gun and bullet and bomb kind of thing, but when actually, if someone feels that he or she has a position, a point to tell the others, here is the platform for you to tell the point and defend this point against other similarly valid points related to the subject. And it's not to propagandize your views, but it's actually to try to prove that your point is valid and may take over some other points of view. So that's the whole idea. For us, it is important that Iraqis actually talk to each other and express opinions, are not scared to do that, are doing it in a civilized manner. Over there, Iraqi side looks at us as a journalist, as a professionals, as a foreign company that works there, which is true. We de jure, we are a foreign company. So the question there is that whether it helps us or not. I'd say on many occasions it doesn't. Luckily, on much more occasion, it doesn't matter so far. Maybe it might change. And of course, there are instances, because we know that the press is or the media, people from the media are mistreated in Iraq massively, that spills over to us. And our guys know that our trademark and our image as an independent, balanced, unbiased news organization is our best defense let's put it this way, that Iraqi politicians, they respect us, whether they agree or disagree with the way we operate, whether they like us or dislike us personally. They do respect us because we do not twist. Some of them clearly are trying to avoid talking to us simply because they might not like us. They don't pick up the phone, or they hang up on us, or, you know, they find ways. On the ground, it's getting even more complicated because you have a bunch of armed people there, and you know, you're lucky if those guys are more or less disciplined, you know, government or somehow organized. But if it is like an armed individual who is after your wallet, you don't, or whatever it is, I mean, you don't know. Despite that, of course, despite all of that, we still have two people who were killed. Unfortunately, one of them was tortured before being killed. We had a person who was kidnapped, and luckily the person was recovered, so without harm. That was a very heavy toll on the families of those guys, on friends of those guys, on the colleagues who were living the situation through, because many of the, well, we're, you know, friendly with each other. Again, interestingly enough, we have people of different beliefs, different sects, different political views. The issue here is our work and our team and our cooperation is not about I'm this and you're that. It's about that we don't care about it. We respect each other's feelings, but the way that someone is different from you doesn't get into the way of cooperation.
And you guys have done some reports on some recent attempts at censorship measures being implemented in Iraq. What effect do you think they will have on your operations, if any?
Iraqi society has this tremendous memory of the past. And unfortunately, it's so suppressing that, you know, that is why you have to be very careful when you enact anything that is aimed at control on that level. So of course, trying to control the internet is a very alarming indicator. You can say, well, we're trying to root out, you know, un-Islamic, you know, pornography. Where is this limit to control? What is pornography? What is not pornography? Can you extend this blanket over some other shady areas that someone finds immoral? And how far you can go with that? It's very delicate. It's very sensitive. So this is an area that really needs to be watched. There should be definitely mechanisms that are watching the situation, even if that is implemented. So far, it's not implemented. We do not know how it is going to be. The funny thing, we were doing a program about it. We brought together three people, virtual panel discussion over the phone. 15 minutes into this discussion, people started arguing at the point that they started screaming at each other, calling each other names. It turned pretty nasty. People ran out of arguments, of civilized arguments. Then the thing, and actually it was actually the side that we expected to be initially to be the most tolerant and most willing to keep conversation going.
Yeah.
So we were very surprised when like the person hang up the phone. Interestingly enough, this person, a couple minutes later, called us back and said, well, you know what, let's continue. Sorry for the outbreak, blah, I understand that this was a mistake. I don't want to ridicule anyone of the participants of this debate, but it shows how difficult it is to try to work it. And for us, I think it's like a medal. When we had this, it helped the guys who participated in this debate because they actually saw what happens when you do it. They imagined themselves being elsewhere, being, you know, sort of caricaturized.
Yeah.
If they were elsewhere, not here, and they reconsidered. So they kept. They didn't arrive at the conclusion. Everyone remained at his own views or her own views, but the idea was the importance that people understood how important it is to keep this dialogue running. The other thing is that they exchanged the ideas. They tried to understand the other side, why, the reasons for certain actions, the reason for certain reaction, They try to argue whether it's reasonable, not reasonable, you know, whether people are oversensitive, intolerant, or something like that.
What do you think Radio Free Iraq's greatest success has been in the recent past, and also what your greatest challenge will be at the moment and moving into the future?
Well, the greatest success, I think we had many things that we could be proud of. Among them, probably, I would select one episode when the issue was that we were not the first ones to cover a story, but the right thing was that we got the story right. I think that was one of our quite recent successes. And that was a story when a lot of media reported that there is a coup d'etat in Iraq, and it wasn't there. And we were under a lot of pressure because a lot of agencies were coming out with stories related to that. And our colleagues on the ground were saying that anything but that angle of the story. So it's a very difficult for any editor to go against the stream when everyone is reporting. It's like to break the story is easy, but to go against the stream. The question was for us was important to keep our integrity in reporting things as they are. And although this evidence was piling up, this evidence was based on the information that was partially unchecked. But the problem was that the intensity of this evidence was piling up so quickly that it was really very difficult to say that we see something different. We took this decision as a group. The group members stuck to this decision despite this pressure. And despite this, you know, just adrenaline in the blood that you have to, this is a breaking story. Why are we late? We trusted our sources. We trusted our colleagues on the ground who were, you know, indicating different. So that was, I think, the biggest success. Disappointing is also when we get some story and we can't report it. We get it either at the time when we are not on air live, or we get the story but we can transmit it from our bureau to the broadcast headquarters. And recently we had a couple of occasions when that would happen. So that is inadequate equipment. The overall largest challenge is to keep everyone safe and alive in Iraq. That's the biggest challenge. We can't protect the guys. We don't have the guns, and we don't have the tanks, and we don't have the aircraft, and, you know. Resources is also the most painful thing that we can talk about. It's technical equipment. We're trying to be a 21st century multiple media news organization, which means it's technology. Everything. I mean, if there is no electricity, the 21st century news organization doesn't produce anything because, you know, everything runs on electricity except for people. We are at the level when electricity can paralyze us. Our lines are very slow. Our phone communication is not dependable. We have only one landline in the office in Baghdad. So everything is dependent on mobile networks. It's better than nothing, and people actually can do better with their mobile phones moving around. We receive the guy sends us a story. He sends us the audio story. Then he sends us a picture, and he says, "You know what? Expect two more pictures by 2 a.m. tomorrow." Why? Because the current speed of my internet will not allow me to upload it faster. So is it like, I understand that he is not sitting in the high-tech, you know, Dubai office, but, you know, we're a professional organization. We're competing with others. Talking about, you know, our technology, we still have some equipment in Baghdad that bears the marks of the explosion which happened in November 2005, meaning that it's good. I mean, like, and running, and we're saving every dime, because we could have said that, well, look at this dent in this thing, you know, just we need to replace it. Technicians recently sent a picture of one of such kind of artifacts, saying, well, this computer is very good, except that nothing but the screen and keyboard works, and we can use it only for one. So there is no sound card. There is no, you know, you can't listen to anything. You can manipulate the mouse. You can do this. You can do that. Well, but it's still able to record. So we are using this computer to record something like, you know, just the feeds from television. On one hand, it's funny. On the other hand, it's good that the guys are trying to use every bit of what we have. Whenever we are losing someone from our team, so a person goes elsewhere, we could only sort of make ourselves not that much unhappy by thinking that someone is getting actually a pretty good journalist. I have to say that our journalists are quite precious in Iraq. So lots of news organizations is eyeing our guys. So this is a challenge.
Some people might find it odd that a Russian is the head of RFERL's Iraq service. So maybe you could explain how you managed to find yourself in this position.
I would have never dreamed, actually, frankly speaking, to become even a member of the Iraqi service, because I was working with other service here in the company. The question was that at some point they needed a replacement for the management, and the reason was that the service was supposed to be closed, and that happened in 2004. So they needed someone temporarily to run the service to its final day on air. I am absolutely sure that the managers were considering many people there. I think that the reason why they finally selected me was not because I was Russian or whatever it is, but because I was I have some training and background in the Middle East. I do speak Arabic, which is not the most important part here, because I never go on air, and there is a reason for that. I'll also explain it. And also, at that point, I was doing some reporting on Iraq, so I was kind of in the picture. So I guess that was a number of reasons why I was selected. I was told during brief course of crisis management training that I received, the trainer looked at me. That was the beginning of our training. She looked at me and said, like, "Huh, you're the one who run the Iraq service to its closure." I said, like, "Well, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, that I was picked, and, you know, that was the decision." She said, like, "Well, yeah, that's... No, I understand what." Like I said, like, "What's the problem?" She said, like, "Well, your look is completely foreign to the Iraqis who work in the service. And that's true. I have a light, you know, pale complexion, light eyes, like light hair, completely different from what you would expect from the Middle Oriental person. And of course, this causes some psychological tension. So she said, like, "You have to work on it, because, you know, otherwise, whether you want it or not, people will feel uncomfortable talking to you." I don't know how much that is true, but I'm happy that we don't really have problems of that kind. So sometime in the middle of that several months work of a project, we figured out that the service is not going to be closed. So that's how I found myself on a temporary assignment that turned out to be just several years worth of work. And I was really very happy that at some point it became clear that the service is not going to be shut down by a certain date, because I thought that it had a reason to exist. It still has a reason to exist, I believe. The reason is changing as the situation is in Iraq is evolving. The question here is that the service is also evolving and trying to adapt itself to the new tasks and new challenges. And I think that's the reason for the vitality. We managed to keep as many listeners who used to listen to us over the years. But because from the very beginning, the service was very much Iraqi-oriented, and we kept this trend. The Iraqis clearly see this, that all we do is about Iraq, for the Iraqis, and by the Iraqis. And that is the reason why I never go on air. I mean, like, I was on air a couple of times just saying hello or congratulations with the new year when other people were doing it in the choir. But that's basically it is. And I, my job there is not to deliver the news, but my job there is to create conditions that the service most effectively
right.
does this job
yeah.
and creates and delivers the news. So that's basically it is.